Chapter 24. Chloroform is a thing I don't happen to be frightfully well up on. All I know is what I read in the thrillers. But in ordinary circs, I imagine, it doesn't take the bloke on the receiving end very long to come out from under it. And had all this occurred in the afternoon's earlier stages, I've no doubt that I should have been up and about in no time as good as new. But it will be recalled that I had had rather a full day, of a nature to tax the constitution and sap the vitality and all that, and that I hadn't been any too robust to start with. The result was that, having gone off like a lamb, I stayed off like a lamb, taking no interest in the proceedings for a very considerable time. I have a sort of dim recollection of going along in a car and fetching up at a house and being carried in, but the first thing I really remember is waking up in bed and finding that it was the next morning. Bright sunlight was streaming in at the window, one or two birds were doing a spot of community singing, and the distant sound of church bells told that it was Sunday. There's nothing like a good sleep for putting one in form. Tired nature's sweet restorer, somebody calls it, and he's not far wrong. I was delighted to find that, except for a little stiffness about the curves, natural after that paper knife episode, I felt quite myself again. I rose and went to the window and looked out. The house stood at the bottom of a lane, at the end of which was a main road of sorts. The Ventura Boulevard, I discovered that it was later. This was a part of the country I had not seen before, and I was examining it with interest when I suddenly became aware of a scent of sausages and coffee so powerful and inviting that I sprang for my clothes and started making my simple toilet without further delay. A moment before, I had been speculating as to the chances of these birds who'd kidnapped me cutting fingers and things off me and slipping them in the parcel post in order to encourage the Christmas spirit in whoever was supposed to kick in with my ransom. But it didn't seem to matter so much now. I mean to say, if they let me get at those sausages first, I wasn't disposed to be fussy about what they did afterwards. I was nearly ready for the dash downstairs when there was a bang on the door and a voice spoke.
"Hello there," it said. "What ho," I replied. "How's it coming?"
"How's what coming?
How do you feel?
Hungry?"
"Okay, there's sausages and pancakes."
"Pancakes?" I said, my voice trembling.
"Sure," replied this unseen bloke,
a matey desperado.
"You just slip on something loose and come and join the party."
2 minutes later, I was in the living room, taking my first look at the gang. They were seated round a table on which was a dish of sausages so vast that the sight of it thrilled me like a bugle. It was plain that there was going to be no stint. As these were the first kidnappers I had met, I drank them in with a natural curiosity. There were three of them, all wearing full-size beards, which made them look like a group photograph of Victorian celebrities. I can't say that all this foliage made for chic, but I suppose fellows in their line of business are obliged to think more of the practical side of things than of appearances. In any case, things were not as bad as they might have been. The beards were false ones. I could see the elastic going over their ears. In other words, I had fallen among a band of criminals who were not willful beavers, but had merely assumed the fungus for purposes of disguise. It may be that this discovery prejudiced me in their favour, but I must say they seemed very decent coves. There appeared to be a distinct disposition to set the young guest at his ease. They introduced themselves as respectively George, Eddie, and Fred, hoped I'd slept well, and invited me to seat myself at the table. George helped me to sausages. Eddie said that the pancakes would be along in a minute, and that if the sausages were not fixed as I liked them, I had only to say the word. And Fred made a civil apology about the chloroform.
"I'm sorry about that, kid," he said. "You're feeling all right after it, eh?"
"Never better," I assured him, "never better."
"Swell. You see, George and Eddie been giving me the raz on account of me slipping the sponge on you that way."
"You shouldn't ought to have did it," said George, shaking his head.
"'Tisn't as if he'd been likely to have squawked," said Eddie.
"Yeah, I know," said Fred, "but there's a right way and a wrong way of doing everything. A fella's got his technique, hasn't he? The artist in a fella's got to have the expression, hasn't he?"
"That's enough," said George, who appeared to be something in the nature of president of this organization, speaking with a rather frigid note of rebuke. "You go and look after those pancakes."
"Oh, shoot," mumbled Fred, evidently dashed poor chap.
"I don't see where a fellow's technique's got to be stifled." He shuffled off into the kitchen, and George seemed to think it necessary to make an apology for him.
"No hard feelings, I hope," he said. "Fred thinks too much about technique. It's his temperament. You've got to excuse it." I begged him not to give the matter another thought.
"Anyway," said Eddie, "I'll say this for him. He cooks a pancake that has to be tasted to be believed."
And shortly afterwards Fred returned with a smoking platter, and I tested the statement and found it correct. I'm not ashamed to confess that I pitched in till my insides creaked. It was only some little time later that I found myself in a position to listen to the breakfast table conversation. Like all other breakfast table conversations taking place at that moment in the Hollywood zone, it dealt with the motion pictures. George, who was reading the Sunday paper while he stirred his coffee absently with the muzzle of his automatic, said he saw where this new purity drive seemed to be gaining ground. He read out a paragraph about there being a rumour that Mae West's next picture was going to be Alice in Wonderland. Fred and Eddie said they were glad to hear it. Eddie said it was certainly time somebody came along and threw water on the flames of the tidal wave of licence which had been poisoning the public mind, and Fred said, yay, that was about the way he had always felt. "This is going to be a break for you, kid," said George. "Your stuff's clean." "Ah," said Fred. "You'll find yourself on top of the heap."
"Sure," agreed Eddie. "He'll reap his reward."
"If," said George, striking a warning note, "they give him the right sort of story. Clean or not clean, you gotta have a strong, human, compelling story. These guys that do your stuff, kid, they don't seem to have a good story sense."
"Ah," said Fred. "You gotta watch out for that, kid," said Eddie.
"It's the system that's wrong," said George. "I blame the studio heads."
"The moguls," said Eddie.
"The mandarins," said Fred. "The Hitlers and Mussolinis of the picture world," said George. "What do? They ship these assortments of New York playwrights and English novelists out here and leave it all to them. Outside talent don't get a chance."
"Ah," said Fred.
"Well, look at," said George. "Some guy from outside grabs him a swell idea for a picture, and what happens? The more he submits it to the script department, the more they don't read it. I've got a whale of an idea at this very moment for a story for you, kid, but what's the use? They wouldn't so much as look at it."
"Was that the one you were telling us about Tuesday?" asked Eddie.
"The one about Public Enemy number 13? Asked Fred.
"Sure, that's the one," said George, "and it's a pippin."
"You bet it's a pippin," said Eddie.
"That's just about what it is," said Fred.
I finished my pancake. "It's good, is it?" I said.
"I'll say it's good," said George.
"I'll say it's good," said Eddie.
"I'll say it's good," said Fred.
"I expect it's good," I said.
"Listen," said George in a sort of ecstasy. "Listen, kid, get a load of this and see if it's not like mother makes. There's this gangster that's been made Public Enemy number 13, see? And he's superstitious, see? And he feels he won't never have any luck so long as he's got this 13 hoodoo, see? So what does he do?"
"Get this, kid," said Eddie.
"Get this, kid," said Fred. They were leaning forward, their beards twitching with excitement. "He's too kind-hearted to go shooting up one of the public enemies that's higher on the list, though he knows that if he does, that'll make him Public Enemy number 12.
"I see it as a Lionel Barrymore part," said Eddie.
"Warner Baxter," said Fred.
"Bill Powell," said George curtly, putting them both in their places. "So he gets an idea for pulling a play that'll put the government wise to how good he is, so maybe they might even promote him to number 1 or 2. And here's the idea. Him and his gang get on a liner that's carrying a lot of gold across to the other side, and they hold up the captain and the officers and take charge of the ship and steer for the coast of South America. And when they're there, they're going to blow the boat up and escape into the interior with the gold. See?" I didn't want to damp the chap, but I had to point out a flaw. I mean, after all, that's what these story conferences are for. "I don't think you need be discouraged," I said. "I can see you got an idea, but you haven't worked it out." George bridled. "How do you mean? What's wrong with that ship sequence?"
"You get your comedy there," said Eddie. "You'd make the captain a comedy type. I see Charles Butterworth."
"Joe Cawthon," said Fred. "Edward Everett Horton," said George. "Where's your love interest?" I asked quietly. The question plainly rattled them. George scratched his chin, Eddie and Fred, their left cheek and head respectively.
"Love interest," said George. He brightened. "Well, how does this strike you? Coast of South America, girl swimming out to the anchored ship. The air is heavy with the exotic perfume of the tropics."
"Flamingos," suggested Eddie, deferentially.
"Sure," said George, "flamingos. The air is heavy with the exotic scent of the tropics, and a cloud of pink flamingos drifts lazily across the sky. And there's this here now practically naked girl swimming out to..." I shook my head.
"Too late," I said. "By the time you get to South America, you're in your fourth reel."
George banged the table.
"Well, hell," he said, "never mind about the love interest."
"You've got to have the heartthrob," I insisted.
"No, you haven't. None of your story's strong enough. Look at All Quiet on the Western Front."
"Yeah," said Eddie. "And Skippy."
"Yeah," said Fred. "And the Lost Patrol. How much do you think that one grossed?"
"I still maintain that you must have a love interest."
"Don't you worry about love interest," said George. "Let's get on to where you blow in. These gangsters scuttle the ship, see? And they get off in the boat, see? Same as in Mutiny on the Bounty, see? And, well, sir..."
"Well, sir," said Eddie.
"Well, sir," said George, "supposing that in this boat there's a little bit of a golden-haired boy, cute."
"Ah," said Fred.
"Got the idea," said George, rising.
"Is that good or is it good? Hey, Fred, Eddie, come on over here. Squat down on this rug. Look at, kid, the rug's the boat, and there's nobody in it but just the gangsters and you, see? And they fall for you."
"They love you," said Eddie.
"Ah," said Fred. "That's what they do," said George. "They love you. And there's only just so much food and water, so the gangsters push each other overboard, so you will have enough..."
"Until," said Eddie,
"there's only," said Fred.
"Until," said George, "there's only you and Public Enemy Number 13 left."
"And get this kid," said Eddie. "Who..."
"Yes, get this kid," said Fred. "Who do you think?"
"Yes, tilt up your ears for the big smash kid," said George.
"Who do you think Public Enemy Number 13 turns out to be?"
"Just your long-lost father, that's all. Nothing but that.
Maybe there ain't a smacko. There's a locket you're wearing round your neck, see?
And this bozo takes a slant at it while you're asleep, see?"
"And," said George, "it's yes, sir, sure enough, the picture of the dead wife he loved."
At this point I interrupted the story conference. "Hands up," I cried, pointing the pistol which George the silly Juggins had left lying by his cup. "Hands up, you frightful bounders.